to the first class of what's it called, integral models, I think. You'll notice that I'm not Kevin Costello. he has longer hair. Yeah, he has more hair than me and more knowledge. So, but he's going to be away until Friday, and I'll be covering the first three talks. So, he kindly wrote some notes up, though, so I'm basically probably will say what he would say, I hope. But in any case, maybe if we asked him nicely, he will share them. I'm not sure. But great. So today, and for the next few talks, the plan is to talk about vertex models. So let me just start by saying, today's talk is going to be called Vertex Models of Statistical Mechanics. I'm not used to these long boards, so.
Are we not going to talk about like what integral models are, why we care? Just go in for it.
Yes. Okay. That's my plan. Maybe Kevin will give a better spiel, but.
I think it's probably Kevin should give the overview of the course. You can also read the overview of the course on the SciWiki and the email I sent you. So, because Alex is not going to be covering the whole course, so it's probably best.
I should also give the caveat that I'm really a mathematician, and this is my first time in a physics classroom since undergrad, which was almost 10 years ago. So take anything I say with a grain of salt, but and please feel free to stop me, if I'm not motivating something or I'm being too mathy or whatever other questions you might have. But I can say we're going to start with vertex models, which is sort of like a simple, almost combinatorial kind of picture, discretized for possibly you could think of it as sort of like a, well, we're going to use the analogy that it's sort of like a discretized version of quantum field theory. And the goal will be to sort of see what kind of interesting stuff you can do with that in the next couple talks. So, So what is a vertex model? So what is it? It's meant to be a classical statistical model. Which lives on a lattice. For the purposes of this, a sort of planar square lattice, in fact. What do we mean? Like some sort of grid, essentially. Say, we're going to take them to be finite, actually. So it's not as though this is continuing to infinity, although you might think of it that way. And what do we do with this picture? Well, there's sort of two pieces of data we need to talk about. One is what does it mean for a configuration on the lattice? And second, how do you associate energies to configurations? So what is a configuration? So I'm not really used to these. So a configuration in this context will mean we're going to associate some labels to the edges, which you could think of as spins. So labeling of the edges by just some numbers. And we're going to fix, it won't necessarily be 2, but maybe n, where n is just some fixed amount. So everywhere you just, on every single edge, you put a number. That's a configuration. Which you might call spins, if you like. And the energy of a configuration is going to be prescribed by a little bit more data. It's only going to be sort of local at each vertex. So the energy is prescribed. By choosing sort of Boltzmann students, yeah. Weights, which I will write as, I know I wrote the entire board with, but B, I, J, K, L, where all of these indices are spins. Yes.
When you say spins, so the edges, so you're not numbering the edges, but the spin that those edges are carrying.
Yes.
So 1 to n, meaning that.
Oh, that's right. You could have the same number many times.
Right.
They're not ordered or anything.
Right. So it's like some classical spin.
Yes. Yeah, that's right.
NHR.
That's right. So, sorry, maybe I should have drawn one. Just as an example, well, this is too big for me to bother labeling, but maybe this, I don't know. We could just label everything by one if we wanted. Maybe something like this. So every edge there has some number, some spin associated to it. Yeah, thank you. Oh, I missed one. I don't know. Two. The middle edge. And, okay, sorry, so this notation looks a little confusing. So it depends on four indices. And namely, what we're doing is actually at each vertex, you sort of look at what are the spins labeling these edges. So each one's carrying a label. Like, let me make sure I get the label right. This is just a choice of convention, but I, J, K, L. So sort of, you could think that you're kind of, well, as we will talk about later, we're going to think of eventually of this as sort of some sort of matrix. And it's, you could think that sort of transforming I to K and J to L or vice versa. So these numbers, though, are just sort of fixed. And they will not depend on which vertex you look at. Any vertex will sort of have the same Boltzmann weights prescribed. So that's just something we fixed at the beginning of this whole pitch. So in that case, then, energy per vertex, effectively, it's going to be negative log B I J K L.
So why is it then useful to have indices on B if they're the same numbers?
Oh, sorry. So thank you. As we range, so for example, whatever n may be, each of these could take any of the values from 1 to n independently, right? So there's actually, you could think of this as a tensor with sort of, what is it, n to the 4 components. So you could choose all of them independently. But it's just that whatever configuration I give, I'm going to do an example in a moment which just has sort of 6 allowed possibilities. Those may be independent, but whenever you see a particular configuration, like here we have 1, 1, 2, 2, and that will have an energy associated to it. 1, 2, 2, 1, that has some other energy associated to it. But if we change this to, let's just make it so they're both the same. So now, if we look at each vertex, we're seeing locally the same picture, right? They both look like 1, 1, 2, 1.
Then the B will be
the same. Yes. OK. And I think there's a useful analogy, which we're going to revisit throughout this talk, which is that this is some discretized version of QFT. So let me say it this way. The spins on the edges, you can think of that as something like the fields. And note that by discretized, we're actually discretizing time as well as space. So later we'll talk about maybe you want to think of one of the directions as time and the other one as the spatial direction. So this. In which case this, let me get it right, negative log of the Boltzmann weights something like the Lagrangian. So the data is sort of analogous, and we'll see that a lot of the expressions are actually analogous. So we'll revisit this idea a few times. Any questions so far? Just fixing some data. Yeah. So OK, so locally, we've specified, you know, if you look at any particular vertex, what the energy is if you see spins on its sides. How do you associate energy to a configuration itself, which, remember, is some choice of labeling on all the edges? You just sort of multiply all those things together. So given I'm just using the notation sigma. So sigma, this is one. This would be an example of a choice sigma. We define the energy E of sigma. Actually, let me write this here. By this equation, E to the negative energy is a product over the vertices B of the Boltzmann weights. What's the notation here? I'll write this and then explain it in a second. So VL for left, VD for down. Oh, maybe I wrote that backwards, actually. OK. Sigma VR for right, VU for up. Yes, I think I got that backwards. J, I'm sorry, J should be here. Anyway, there's some choices involved. And what's going on here, it's just if we take a vertex V, so here it is, then we have some spins around it, and we're just labeling them by some stuff. So the spin here should be, so remember, the configuration has a choice of spin on every edge. So here's our vertex V. The spin here is V. Left, and so on. Is that clear? I mean, more simply put, once we've chosen these, here we have a Boltzmann weight for that vertex, which is going to be from this choice of spins, and here we have another one. Multiply the two together.
Is it important if we have, like, for example, the two down or the two on the left, or that it's symmetric? Because it looked like it would be symmetric, but do we care about
not necessarily, yeah. Maybe we want to impose something like that. But
the position in the B is important.
It is important, yeah. Once you've chosen a convention, which apparently I chose the wrong one from his notes, but once we chose a convention for which one is left, right, up, and down, the indices will matter. But we might impose something like maybe it's symmetric under, you know, something like time reversal, as we might do later, but not necessarily otherwise. So, is that clear otherwise?
Question? I didn't hear the question.
It's just like because it looks like it would be symmetric, so I don't really care if J is top, bottom, or left, but in the general model,
it does matter which one you mean by left, right, up, and down. So let's keep it like this, left, right. Now I did it again. OK. I think he wants to read them like this. So left to right is natural. Top to bottom is pretty natural. Yes, this is right. I think it should be up and down. Thanks. Of course, if you choose different conventions, you'll get something different. OK. Is that otherwise clear? OK. That's good. What should I do? I guess I could. Is that a reasonable configuration, or is it better to just erase what I've written so far? I'm not used to the room here, so. Okay.
I think that top board, it's not visible because of the light, so
yeah,
it should not be the board that you've just
there. So. Maybe I'll just make a point to just change, so. Okay. So the main thing actually we want is to talk about the partition function associated to this setup. So we define Z to be the following thing. So it's a sum over configurations. Sigma of e to the negative e of sigma. So two things to note. I should say the lattice that we're looking at is fixed, and our Boltzmann weights are fixed. Right? But then we can look at all the possible configurations, and we can sum over them like this. So by what we've just been talking about, we could rewrite this in a few different ways. I guess I'll go horizontally. So we can sum over sigma. Remember, each of these is actually a product over the vertices, so some sort of product over V vertices of what we might denote, for simplicity, something like BV sigma. So by this, I mean this Boltzmann weight right there. And what can we do? We could just rewrite this a little bit differently again. It's just not really doing very much. Let's write this as the exponential of something. So negative sum of log. Let me get the signs right. Negative log BV sigma. So it's two negatives. There. And what's the point of this? So now we can think of this as something else a little bit. This is the negative exponential of a sum of energies with a minus sign. So, and what's this here? This EV sigma is something we talked about before, right? The Boltzmann weights are telling us our energies. So that's all that I mean by that. Okay. So this is actually the formula I should highlight. So this is the partition function. And the reason I highlight it like this is this also sort of shows an analogy with quantum field theory and the partition function there. I guess let's do this. Maybe I can keep analogies on this board. So analogy again. If we had a quantum field theory on a space-time manifold, M, with field phi, I don't know. Some generic letter, Lagrangian L. Then the partition function would be, it'd be an integral over sort of field configurations of x of negative so this is the action. Right, and you can write this sort of thing for the, what we call the partition function. And the analogy between this and the discretized version is sort of, I hope, clear now. We just replaced both the integrals with sums, right? So we've discretized the manifold, so we're sort of summing over some sort of configurations, and instead of having sort of a space of fields, we've discretized that also, and we're summing over. So configurations are becoming the fields, and sort of the space-time manifold is the lattice. That's
it. I guess mathematicians really care about time so much, but should there be an I there, or
possibly, yeah. I think Kevin's using conventions where there's almost no constants, right? I typically probably would put some sort of Boltzmann factors here. But, yes. Maybe we should put an I in the interval.
That's all right.
Any other questions? OK. So this matches our analogy, which is good, I hope. So yeah, well, let's just be a little bit more explicit. So we've discretized sort of M to a lattice. Right? So the points of the manifold now is the vertices of the lattice and the fields configurations. Then our integrals become sums.
It probably makes more sense if we do a weak rotation, because before weak rotation, the Lagrangian isn't really the energy, right? But it's after the weak rotation.
Okay. Wow. I'll stick to his notes for now, but that's probably a fair criticism. Any other questions or comments so far? Let me say one more thing before sort of actually mentioning an example, which may be more interesting. Right. We can talk about boundary conditions. So there's a few natural things you might do. Okay, it's not completely visible, but we have our lattice. We might restrict which configurations we allow. So, and there's two very natural choices, which is. First of all, we could consider a doubly periodic boundary condition. So periodic. What does that mean here? Well, the sort of lattice has a top and a bottom. So if we have our picture of like so, we can restrict to only considering ones where the spin at the top is equal to the one at the bottom, and same thing at the sides, right? So we don't restrict what spins we allow at the top and bottom, but they must be equal. So this one must be equal to that one, and so on. I know I'm changing my labels around. So and so on the top and sides. So in other words, we're sort of wrapping in it to become something like a torus. Or second, just by fixing the values at the boundary. So again, here that we allow I, J, et cetera, arbitrary, but equal at top and bottom. And a second natural thing is just to strictly impose what they are at the top and bottom, not necessarily periodic. So, for example, let's just take the same picture. We could just force that everything is equal to 1 at the side for some reason. And then allow the inner edges to all change. And we can make sense of all of what we said by just only looking at those configurations. So we might just restrict what configurations we sum over somehow. So with some choice. Okay. So maybe we should do an example. For now, I'll just cycle them, but. I don't know if this is the right way to do things, but. So one of the most famous examples is something called the six-vertex model, or the ICE model, or ICE-like. And it's an example which is sort of physically interesting. I'll mention a reference, but also mathematically interesting. So what's going on here? So remember, at the beginning, we chose what ranges our spins can run over. So here we're going to take n equals 2. So there are only 2 spins. So rather than calling them 1 and 2, let's call them, say, 0 and 1. So. And more than that, I'm going to steal this color. Let's just draw them a little bit differently. So I'll draw the 0 as, some sort of dashed line, and the 1 is red. Why I dash both, but let's just ignore. Why dash one and not the other? But OK. So here we're going to very heavily restrict what configurations are allowed. We're only going to have 6 of them, hence the name. So one of them is just all dotted. The second one is, I'm going to draw it a little bit funny. So everything is red, but sort of thinking of them as separated. Third is white horizontal, but then red vertically. And the flip of that. And then finally, 2 more. Like that. So we could label them if we like. This is sort of the first allowed configuration, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth. So what's the point of doing this separation like this? If you actually imagine drawing a lattice with these allowed configurations, then you'll note that any path involving the reds closes. Right? So the only boundary sort of stuff, the only time you'll have an open curve will be at the boundaries. So I'll let you think about that a little bit. But for example, you know, if you put this configuration beside this one, you'll end up with a red circle. And the other things. And so really what we need to prescribe then is just some Boltzmann weights for each of these 6. Right?
The same is true for the dashes, right?
Yes, I think so, yeah.
Sorry? Why cannot the vertex is only 1 red and 3 whites?
We just don't allow it.
Oh, independent model subject.
Yes. So I think you could probably think of that a couple of ways. One, you could say, again, we're just only restricting to certain configurations. You could also sort of imagine that the Boltzmann weight is kind of just going down to zero. So maybe the energy is kind of going up to infinity or something. So we just only fix these six. There's also something called the 8-vertex model. There are several of these things, but that's right. So here we then have sort of, we could call our Boltzmann weights something else just to simplify notation. I'll follow Kevin's notation, which is, we could, since we've already numbered them, we just have sort of six number, we have six real numbers, or complex. Here they are. And, right, I want to leave the partition functions. So if you look online or in a book at this model, frequently you'll see it with oriented arrows instead of red and white. Like people might draw this as like some arrangement of arrows coming into and out of the vertex. And actually, that's what kind of makes this relevant to, or makes it clearer to see why this is maybe physically relevant. This is related to like ice, for example. So let me give some reference. So for example, there's a book by Baxter called Exactly Solved Models in Statistical Mechanics. Chapter 8. It describes some physical connections or physical interpretations of this model, but roughly speaking, my impression is the lattice is actually, so if you take a actual ice, so H2O, then the oxygen is the lattice. And actually, red or white, although it's a little bit hard to interpret in this case, the different weights are coming from where are the hydrogen atoms. So the hydrogen will be kind of closest to, you'll have your oxygen vertex and you'll have two hydrogens somewhere around it on two of the four. And if you think about, so if you're only allowed to choose two out of the four different edges, you'll have six choices, which is the six appropriately interpreted. So that sort of clear. Apparently, it's also useful as a model of certain other ices or cold matter. And we might impose some other constraints on these Boltzmann weights. So frequently, that's what ends up happening. Sort of, which models can you say the most about? Or you might need to impose some extra conditions. Like some of these might need to be equal, for example. Any questions? So I should say, for some physical interpretation. Okay. So, so far, what we've been talking about, via this analogy, is some sort of approximation of quantum field theory, maybe, where you've discretized things. And so far, it's been sort of in a path integral type of formulation. And actually, a lot of the most interesting results about these vertex models come from reinterpreting instead in the Hamiltonian picture, so sort of doing some sort of time evolution. And that's what we'll talk about now, and will be the focus of, I think, at least Tuesday and Wednesday this week. Different interesting cases in the Hamiltonian type picture. maybe I should say, I mean, why is this Hamiltonian picture nice is, although so far we've been, you know, stuff about configurations and counting, and this is actually sort of about probability in a way. The Hamiltonian picture makes things more algebraic, so it's more about linear algebra and matrices and things like that. And it's the power of the algebra that sometimes lets you say a little bit more. So that's my bias as a mathematician, though. So. Okay, so what are we going to talk about now is the monodromy and transfer matrices. So again, we're sort of moving from, you could call something like a path integral formulation . Let's now think about things in a little bit more of a Hamiltonian kind of way. So again, I'll put in quotations since time has been discretized here, but that's OK. So here, what we're going to do is sort of designate one of the lattice directions as time. And let me try to make sure I don't mix up any conventions. So the horizontal direction will be time. So. So we'll call. Vertical space. Both are discrete. I should probably start a new board. Sorry. Difficult to decide which board to use here. Okay, so in this picture, there's going to be some Hilbert spaces involved. And this is where the kind of spins, we should start to think of them as actually being vectors in a vector space. So. Let's see. Essentially, to every horizontal line, we'll associate a Hilbert space. So, I'll draw them in blue, as Kevin has in his notes. So we'll carry a vector space C, n for the spins. So the basis is sort of in bracket notation. And so this is sort of the local Hilbert space for that edge. So if we have some configuration like, say, k times, then we should associate the tensor product.
not a classical picture, or?
I think so. Where I hesitate to definitively say, I believe so. Okay. And so we want to think of some sort of discrete time evolution, sort of, as we said, we want to think of this in a Hamiltonian sort of way. So we kind of want to allow ourselves to do time steps. And so let me write what's written here. So I'll draw this in a moment, it'll become clearer, but this is, again, analog of something like e to the h, h the Hamiltonian, again, possibly neglecting i's. Which I think makes the most sense if once you draw it. So this is going to depend on some spatial boundary conditions. So space, remember, is the vertical direction. So the top and bottom of our picture will have some boundary conditions imposed. So, pictorially. So if we fix a, again, I'll draw them in blue just to keep them sort of separate. So let's look at a picture like this. One second. At the top, we're going to fix a boundary condition on that edge. We'll fix a boundary condition at the bottom. And if you here on our blue labels, these blue edges, we have this total Hilbert space Cn to the k, tensored a bunch of times. And on the other side, we also do. And what we're going to get is a linear operator which goes from the left to right. Yes?
I wanted to ask, in the case that you want to
Yes, yes. That's right. So that would be the one that's sort of probably most familiar seeming. It would be 2, but in principle, it could be any number if you want it. Exactly. Yeah, we could think of them sort of spin up and down or in the 2 case. Any other questions? OK. So associated to this, we get a monodromy matrix, is the name. Which is, will be denoted M upper I lower J. And this, again, will be some transformation taking the sort of incoming Hilbert space here to the outgoing. So it's a map Cn tensor. K times, say, to itself. And how do you compute it? Well, it's actually going to be, I just erased it, but it's going to be a partition function. So how do we actually evaluate this thing? So again, that's to draw in the picture. How do we say? Let's compute the matrix entries. So this is a linear operator. It's it can be represented as a matrix. You can think of picking out the matrix entries. So we can have some incoming state. I'll just follow this. L1. So let's take some basis element of this Silbert space here, the tensor product. And and the outgoing state, say M1 to well, what do we do? We're actually just going to put those labels on the sides and compute a partition function. So to compute that matrix entry, the partition function. For the arrangement where it's the exact same, but we've added boundary conditions on the edges at the left and right. So we still have I and J here and here, but up to order of what way we put things. So here we have each of these as a spin. We can just label these with these spins. And same thing on the other side. So now we're looking at some sort of configurations with prescribed boundary, and we can compute the partition function. So just to be explicit, it's kind of a mess, right? Each of these inner edges is kind of free to be any spin, and we need to sum over all of those, which is a bit of a pain, but so the configurations that we need to sum over is just changing the vertical line part. So and we will get sort of this M, I don't want to write it that way. The partition function we'll get will be a huge sum where if we start calling, say, this R, make sure I don't mix up his indices. I think he's labeled R1 to RK minus 1 up there. Maybe let me do this. So here we're going to add some sort of extra variable, R1. There's an R2, and so on. Here we'll have RK minus 1. Right, there are K minus 1 pieces in between. Those are free to change. So we need to sum over all possible values of those, which are running from 1 to n. And then we get this huge expression, which is the product of the Boltzmann weights, like at the beginning of the talk. Let me make sure I get this right. Hopefully, I have. If this seems like a mess, it's because it is. J bottom, right, OK. I think we may be mixing up top and bottom, but OK. Anyway, I think probably you get the idea. Well, probably I did make a mistake in the conventions. But there's a better way to interpret all this, which is think of this as some sort of matrix multiplication. So let's talk about that. Since it makes it much cleaner. So far, maybe this seems still sort of complicated, but how to interpret this a little bit nicer. Well, the sort of trick is to, yes.
Sorry, I don't understand. So R's are inserted anytime the blue line is crossing the
Yeah, that's right. So if I erase the R's, right, there are some edges in between the blue lines which don't have any spins. And so those can be arbitrary,
yeah.
Right?
So why is there k minus 1 number of R's inserted?
Because between, you know, if I cut it k times.
So you're inserting the R's, you're missing, okay, now I understand. Okay.
Yeah, sorry. Yes, I should have maybe just drawn a picture with the exact number of R's. I mean, exact number of blue lines. So, yeah. They're just some dummy spin index. So what's the interpretation? We view the Boltzmann weights B, I, J, K, L as a linear operator. Now I've forgotten what convention we're using somehow already, which is, it's going to be an operator from sort of Cn, tensor Cn, to Cn, tensor Cn, where each of these is corresponding to a different, one of the different adjacent edges to this vertex. So how did I do it now? I to K, I think it's like this. Is that right? So sort of the input incoming states are here, outgoing on the bottom and right. So things are kind of going down and to the left. So you can think of I as being the left, for example.
Yeah.
This is up. This is right. This is down. Is that clear? B, I, J, K, L is exactly the information of a linear operator from this space to that space. It's the right number of indices. And then what is this monodromy matrix? It's actually just a composition of matrices, but only in the vertical direction. So only in vertical direction. So if that seems a little confusing, I would just suggest thinking about the case when there's two of them. So what's happening in this situation? Right? You're summing over this intermediate edge here, which is kind of variable. That's exactly like the sum that appears in matrix multiplication, the contraction of the indices. So, and if you do it in a big stack, you get the same idea. Any questions about that? So let me define one more thing and then say why you would consider these things. Well, one reason perhaps is that this is a more compact way of representing the same information, but the other thing I need to define is something called the transfer matrix. T, this is also a linear transformation. It's just a sum of these monodromy matrices. I don't want to go over, so. Remember, the monodromy matrix depends on choosing the spatial boundary condition at the top and at the bottom. You can take them either the same. You can look at things which where the state was actually sort of preserved under this operation. And then you could sum those all together. So this is just a sum of n matrices. So it's also a linear transformation from Cn, tensor k to itself.
that string of these, the matrices that you wrote, that is the monomial string.
Yes, yes, that's right. Acting on those particular, right. On that particular incoming and outgoing. So this is actually a matrix entry of the monitoring matrix.
Yeah, okay.
But yes.
Mm-hmm. Can you clarify again why computing this partition function is the same as computing the matrix elements of the monitoring?
Yeah, so I would say the thing to think about really is this one. So sort of exercise, if you like. Try this one out. But right.
So what's the question again?
Why is this monomial matrix the same as doing a matrix multiplication with these guys?
And I think the question is, like, why are the dynamics determined by the
monomial matrix?
No, by the partition functions.
Is that the question? Sorry. Oh. The partition function. I see. I'm confused as a question. Can you say it again?
Why computing this partition function is equivalent to computing the matrix elements of monodromy matrix?
Oh, I see. That just really, we should go back to the definition. So I think maybe it's better if I erase the R's, but remember, those are just sort of not there. Really, we fix the boundary, we compute that partition function. I mean, I think the way to think about it is if we have I all the way up here and J, so we computed matrix coefficients by putting things on this side. But let's forget that for a moment. Like, we could have kind of broken this. In a way, we're kind of breaking this into the matrix multiplication, is like breaking this into two pieces, where here we still have J, and here we have I. But now we can have the inner indices between the two. So if I let this be R down here, matrix multiplication is sort of contracting these two to have the same value.
I think the question is, like, why are we getting dynamics in this Hamiltonian picture when we choose to call one direction time from the statistics in the Boltzmann weights? I mean,
You could say it really, I would say, ultimately it has to do with the fact that you're looking at vertices with four outgoing edges, right? And, it's something very particular to looking at lattices which are just a grid. So. We could look at a lattice where, you know, you could add like an extra edge from here to here or something. That would not be a matrix multiplication anymore. Here, it's something special about these contractions, but I'm not sure if I can say a better answer than that.
Maybe the question is more related to the physical interpretation, which will become just clear later on once everything is in.
I would say so. I hope that maybe the initial interpretation with the Boltzmann weights, that is more physical in my mind. This, I would say, is more like some sort of gadget to compute that more effectively. So one way to say it is, if you can compute something like the transfer matrix T or the monodromy matrices M, you can actually determine completely the dynamics of the system that you started with. For example, you can compute the partition function. You can compute basically anything you might want.
I think my question is, are you defining the matrix elements of the monodromy matrix by that formula or not?
Yes.
Oh. Okay, that's the definition then.
That's the definition. Okay. Yes, that's right. So why would you define it this way? I guess maybe roundabout would be because it works out in the end, but.
Okay. Can you give us any spoilers on why we're calling it the monodromy matrix?
Oh, well, that's right. So you should think, I think it's because, so we've chosen our sort of time direction. So you could think that something is going on, which is a process from sort of maybe the top to the bottom, proceeding in time. monodromy normally should mean something about how, you know, behavior changes along a path. Normally, you'd be looking at like a closed loop, for example, and maybe, I don't know, you study some connection as it varies along a closed path. That would be monodromy. Right? So here, that's something like that, especially if you fix the spatial states to be equal at the top and bottom. That's like looking at sort of closed loops in time that are getting back to the initial state. So it is monodromy in that sense. We've changed it a little bit by allowing the state to change, but. We're kind of looking at all possible ways of transitioning in time from one state to the next state, with maybe involving some sort of intermediate scattering.
So I thought time flew sideways. Right? So here it's more spatial.
Yeah. Right. One or the other. Any other questions? I guess we should probably stop there. But if there are questions.
So I guess afterwards we're going to use this transfer matrix or this monodromy matrix to get the like the ground states or the excitations.
Yes. Yes. So I can say maybe an advertisement for the next time.
Okay.
What sort of thing? Why would you consider this? You know, something that's nice if you have a matrix is, say, to compute its trace, for example. And it turns out that if I give you a square lattice, you just take some powers of this matrix and compute the trace. That will be the partition function, for example. And you know, the sort of stuff you might think about is, well, how can you compute traces easily? You know, there's stuff about eigenvalues. And it becomes sort of a linear algebra problem. I would say that's maybe one upshot, but. Any other questions? Great, thanks guys. See you tomorrow.